Hello and welcome to the Sorbro Mesa podcast with me, your host, Alan Maguire. Today is Monday the 5th of October 2020 and I'm finally in lockdown. Yes, I cannot leave my neighbourhood here in the capital, Madrid, because we have been quarantined. After 2 weeks of umming and ahhing, the regional government finally decided to follow the central government's advice, although they are still going to be taking the decision to court. However, this reality is not new for everybody. In my first interview today with Sara Soto, she talks about how living in Vallecas has been, as they were locked down a couple of weeks earlier on the 18th of September. She also talks about some of the structural problems and the inequalities that are within the neighbourhood, and they've just been exacerbated by this pandemic. And following that, I interview Simon Hunter. Simon is the editor of El País in English, the biggest English-speaking news outlet on the internet that is covering Spanish current affairs. In this interview, we talk about his podcast, ¿Qué? And where it is, the Spanish response to the coronavirus, both from a governance point of view, but also from, you know, how it's interacted with Spanish culture and the way people live here. And then in the final part of the interview, we touch upon the phenomenon that is James Rhodes. I hope you enjoy the interviews and remember to subscribe and share this podcast with all your friends and family who want to know about what's going on the peninsula. This podcast is available on Apple, Google and Spotify. I hope you enjoy the interviews.
So on the 18th of September, the PP government under Isabel Ayuso put 37 health districts, so they're smaller than a city, but they are within the region of the local GP surgery. Among these restrictions became 50% occupancy of bars. They had to close by 10 p.m. Public parks were also closed. But you could still leave your district if you had to go to work, school, or look after dependents. And it included areas such as Pala, Fuenlabrada, Getafe, which are commuter towns in the south of Madrid. But it also included some inner city district neighborhoods such as Carabanchel, Villaverde, and Vallecas. Today, I have Sara Soto with me. She is the secretary of the Young Socialists of Vallecas organization. Welcome to Sobremesa, Sara.
Hi.
Thanks for joining me. Today, we're gonna do a bit of a recap over, because now the rest of Madrid is in quarantine with you. But, you know, at the time, these 37 districts, it was sort of, it became a bit of a thing over the first weekend, and then it sort of got played down over the 2 weeks. Well, from my point of view, from what I saw. But, you know, I don't live in a district that was quarantined, so I don't really know what it was like. But, you know, what was the feeling and the tension like in Vallecas for those 2 weeks? Did it change at all, or were people quite angry, or?
Well, I would say the general feeling was that it's always us, that uh-huh. For some reason, I mean, I couldn't say for the other districts, but I guess their situation is quite similar. And this neighborhood, it has a very strong sense of its own, of being from this district, because the people inside the district feel like it's their district, but most because the people outside the district always point to them that they're from there. So this was just another layer or another situation where it's evident that the district keeps being pointed out or singled out or just segregated. I don't really like using this word because it has a lot of connotations, but it is true that somehow it was segregated, and it was another situation of why is it always us? And in the first confinement, when the whole country was confined in March, there were also a lot of situations where this one district was singled out. They would always say that it was the place where most fines were given for skipping the confinement, wow, where there were most where people wouldn't really respect the confinement. And it's not really that, it's just that it's overcrowded, there's small flats and everything. So people in the streets in this second confinement were that were already singled out, they were being pointed out again for doing these same things. And it's like, you know what the situation's like, so why would you take these measures that are really not going to solve anything, because people are still having to go out of the district to work. So yeah, I guess it makes them feel unwilling protagonists, let's say, of really, I don't feel that these measures were going to be like the right ones, but this is a personal feeling. And definitely the whole neighborhood was feeling that it was being treated differently and discriminatedly.
And I know that, you know, that feeling of being discriminated against, I think the first weekend, it was on the news, there was some, it seemed what there was like police violence. I'm not sure how much of it. I mean, I saw the same video going around on Twitter. I mean, and it was very much this, because you couldn't go into the quarantine area to see it or anything. And I suppose journalists couldn't either. So you literally just had what was coming out of the districts. But it was like, it was the national police. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the local police. And it seemed like there was a lot of frustration. Like, how did you feel that people reacted to it that weekend? Was it measured, or, you know, was it skewed a bit by the media at all or anything?
The thing with the violent episodes we had, and it's sad in the sense that this violent episodes that happened were really at the very end of the demonstrations. There was this series of demonstrations that happened before the centers of primary health, I don't know how to say it, but
the centers,
yes. So there were concentrations there to demand for the deconfinement of the neighborhoods and for having more medical personnel and more good measures taken, to say it somehow. And the violent episodes were at the very, very, very end of the afternoon, and they weren't before. What the police said is that they weren't demonstrations before the hospitals or the centers, but before the Asamblea de Madrid, which is the local parliament, sort of. And I have the thing is that they weren't in the spirit of making these demands for social for better social welfare or the whole thing, but just more into the general angriness that we have been accumulating. So what I feel about this violent episodes that are, of course, very sad that happened, and nobody should have to feel violence in any case from the police or the police from the demonstrating people, or because we don't really even know how it started, is that we have lost focus. Everyone was talking before about the problems in Vallecas with the lack of doctors, with the lack of measures, with the lack of social services, with the segregation and everything. And now everybody's talking about this violent episode, which was like 20 minutes. And for our demonstrations before, we're completely wiped out.
Yeah, I mean, it's violence always speaks, doesn't it, for the news headlines and clickbait. You know, it's been a bit of a power game in politics, but I wanted to ask you more about, you know, what's actually been happening in the last 2 weeks since the confinement. You know, have social services been increased? Have GPs been increased? Have police numbers been increased? Like, what support has there been given from a regional or national, I don't know which one, but governments? And, you know, has it changed the mood, or are people still, you know, really pissed off, or, you know, what's been happening on the ground rather than in the headlines, I suppose my question is.
Yeah, I feel that these last 2 weeks haven't really eased up any of the issues that Vallecas had. Like, okay, you are going to confine the area, the neighborhood, or the little districts actually, because it felt like there were some streets where the right side of the streets was confined, but the left one wasn't. So it was very, very confusing. And actually, you would feel that, okay, you're going to confine us because there's a high incidence of percentage per 1,000 cases of inhabitants in COVID or something. And you get the feeling that, okay, we're going to get more doctors, we're going to get more nurses, we're going to get more tests at least. But it wasn't the case because I guess I'm not going to say it's against Vallecas, but more like the community doesn't have these resources because they did hire a lot of nurses and doctors back in March or April when the peak of the epidemic was going on, but then they the contracts finished and they didn't rehire all these people, so they have a general lack in resources, in sanitary resources. And then you would think, okay, but we're going to try to open up other areas such as social services, and it hasn't been the case either. Actually, the minimum vital income was approved around May or end of April, May or something. And we have a lot of people in Vallecas living off welfare, or not living off welfare, but having a bit of aid because their salaries are so low that they get a bit of help from the community. And since the community decided that they were going to benefit from the vital income, they would cut off their regional help, so they would get the vital income from the state. So we have this void where there's some people that haven't started receiving the vital income, the minimum vital income, but they have stopped receiving the aids from the community of Madrid. So in that sense, we get many calls from people that don't know how to ask for it, that don't know how to do the whole bureaucratic process of asking for it. Then they don't have income from other sources, or their salaries are so low. Also, we have the big crisis of getting food, which is crazy because, I mean, this is supposed to be a Western country in Europe, and we had people that didn't have anything to eat. And back in the first confinement in March, April, we could see these long lines of people waiting for the NGOs to give them food. Like the community didn't step in that case, so they're probably not going to step in this case either. And then you have the, but it this is almost like a joke, or for me it's a joke because it's I mean, I can't believe it. It has sort of a surreal part to it, which is we can get out of the neighborhood to go to work, but we have to get in these trains that come every 8 minutes, and in the train you have no room to breathe. So what's the point of me staying inside my house if I'm going to take a metro that it's going to where I'm going to stay for like 30, 40 minutes, and I have no room to breathe, and I'm so close to everyone. So they didn't, it's so basic, but they didn't even increase the speed or the frequency of trains coming into the neighborhood. Back in March, we made this really, really strong campaign because she was kids weren't like children in the neighborhood. They didn't have food to eat at home. The whole money that the community has, they put a part of it into what are we going to feed these children, right? And you would think that they would make a plan, like as they did afterwards with some restaurants or some restaurants to make dishes for the kids or anything. But the first thing that they did was buy pizza and send pizza to the kids for weeks. I mean, what kind of political decision is that? And the feeling that we had is that working class kids can eat trash food every day. Of course, I mean, of course I like pizza. Of course I eat pizza even once a week, but or more. But in the richer neighborhoods, or not, let's not say richer, but better off neighborhoods, their kids don't eat pizza once a week. So why are our children good for eating fast food every 2 days? I mean, one day was pizza, next day it was burger.
Wow, really?
So some decisions have been made which didn't make any sense.
So thank you very much for talking to me, Seba. I don't know if there's anything you want to sort of say to summarize, you know, how it's been in Bayekas over the last couple of weeks.
Okay, I'm going to try to summarize. It's true that these last 2 weeks or few weeks have been very hard with the quarantine and the selective quarantine for these neighborhoods. I mean, we were good to go outside to waiter tables for everyone else, but we couldn't go to our bars in our neighborhood, which doesn't make any sense. But I want to say this is not a situation that has been made up the last 2 weeks. There are very, very hard structural differences that have been hitting not only Vallecas, but also Carabanchel and Uceda and all these working class neighborhoods where, of course, the quarantine has aggravated some of the problems, but the bad jobs are there, the terrible living conditions are there, the low incomes are there, also worse health. Like, we have a life expectancy 4 years lower than the center of the city, which is, yes, I know. And this makes, there were already borders within the city between better, let's say better neighbor. No, I don't want to say better, but yeah, more taken care of neighborhoods and the working class neighborhoods. And this segregation that the community put into place, this quarantine, just made the borders physical. Like, okay, now we have this. And now we can see it. And all these decades, for decades, you have been doing this to us. But now it's even physical. We cannot go out. I mean, this, some people were using the word ghetto. I don't like to say ghetto because it has some other connotations. And it's not really, but it's there. And I honestly don't think the neighborhood's going to recover from COVID, not only from this quarantine, but from the one before. If it doesn't get really, really a lot of help, I don't think it's going to recover anytime soon.
Wow. Yeah. And I suppose, you know, with the economy on a national level being completely shot to pieces, the people that are going to suffer first are going to be the people of Bayekas, Carabanchel, in these working class neighborhoods.
Yeah, I mean, in the economic level, or more like the work level, of course, contracts are worse, but not even that. We found out that there's something called the breach, the internet breach, or I don't know how to translate it, but basically 95% of people in Vallecas cannot work from home.
Okay, remote working, So the difference between people that can remote work and can't remote work.
Not only that, the children cannot follow their classes from school, from home, because many of them don't have computers, many of them don't have internet, or just don't have the context at home to be able to work from home, because they might not have a room or space or even the parents that take care of that. So that's even going to put another bridge into place, which is like a bridge of education where our kids have lost a year compared to the kids from other neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So just a lot of problems piling up.
No, definitely. And yeah, as you said, the COVID just exacerbates any inequalities that are already there, which is... it's dreadful, and I hope the response is better, but I'm not going to hold my breath. Thank you very much for coming on, and I hope you'll come on again soon.
I thank you for inviting me, and I would love to come back and tell you more of our sad story. I feel very bad if I sounded like very victimizing, but this is reality. I mean, I didn't exaggerate one bit, so
Thank you. Thank you.
And a thank you again to Sarah for coming on the Sobremesa podcast, and I hope to have her back shortly. And now here is the interview with Simon Hunter.
Hello, today with me on Sobremesa, I have Simon Hunter. Simon is the editor of El País in English, and he's also the host of the podcast Que from El País. So welcome to Sobremesa, Simon.
Thank you, Alan, and congratulations on the podcast, and in particular, congratulations on the name. That's a fantastic name that you've chosen for it.
Oh, brilliant, thank you. Where is Kay these days?
Yeah, well, bless our listeners. I've had some very nice emails over the past 6 months or so asking where we are and saying that they really miss it, which is really great. What happened was when we were approaching the Easter holidays, basically a lot of the people from the video section of El País, which is the section that is responsible for actually editing and putting out the podcast, they were going to be short staffed because people were going on vacation. And I think it was something to do with the interns weren't going to be around. So they asked us if we could put it on hold, because of course, all of a sudden El País was producing a newspaper and a digital online edition with everyone at home, which obviously, you know, not so much for us as the English edition, but for the actual main, the rest of the newsroom was a huge challenge. So they asked us to put it on hold. And to be honest, I'll be brutally honest with you. I just really didn't have it in me to do the podcast. We were locked down in our apartment with our children. I've got a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. So actually, the few podcasts that we did in the lockdown were quite difficult logistically to do, because I had to go. I was actually in my kid's bunk bed with a quilt on my head. I had to take my computer in there because my wife was working from home. My wife is very noisy when she works from home. So it's very hard to find quiet space. But also it was such an intense time. I just actually literally, and we were working so hard and it was so tough. I mean, my kids are amazing and they were fantastic during the lockdown, but it was just such a tough period that I actually just didn't have the headspace to sit there and say, "Hello, everybody. My name," which is how I start every single podcast. So yeah, so we've been on a sort of indefinite hiatus, but now my kids are back at school, and hopefully Veronica and Melissa are going to have some free time. And hopefully we'll get back on the case, because I really miss doing it, obviously. And as I said, our listeners have been very kind and have said that they've missed it as well. So fingers crossed.
I'm looking forward to it coming back. It sounds like you've had your hands full, though. I mean, El País in English, I think, is a bit of a lifeline for a lot of people that retire to Spain and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, every situation has its silver lining. And if you are a journalist and if you work with the news, then it tends to be that, you know, your best days come when something really, really bad happens. I always joke that at the beginning of the year, I kept saying to Melissa, my colleague, I was like, "Yeah, our traffic's dipping a little bit. We need a big story. We need something to happen." So if anyone wants to blame the pandemic on me, then they can. We certainly got that. I mean, you know, we've been in a really interesting situation in the last couple of years, whereby we changed our focus. Our bosses were trying to get us to find an audience in the United States. And because we've got such a big operation in America, Latin America, they figured that the way to do that was to do more stories in English about Latin America. But we've always seen that those stories do not do well. They don't do well either in Europe or in the Americas. So what we did 2 years ago now, a couple of years ago now anyway, is we shifted our focus. We left all the Latin America stuff to the side, and we just really started to focus on Spain. And we found that we got a huge bump in our figures in the United States, and they could be for the strangest of stories. Normally human interest stories, when that poor 3-year-old boy, Julen, fell down that hole down in Andalusia. I mean, we just, you know, we saw traffic, you know, the like of which we had never seen. And most of it was coming from the United States. So that was really interesting. So I never sort of like to think of us. We're not sort of like an expat type publication. We don't do the, you know, those things like, you know, 10 words you need to learn to make you sound like a Spaniard and stuff like that. I mean, what I've always seen us as doing is giving an English speaking audience, you know, news features and opinion from Spanish journalists.
Yeah.
And really giving them, you know, the benefit of the wealth of knowledge and experience and reporting that all of my colleagues do. But obviously, when the pandemic hit in March, we saw just, you know, an incredible spike in traffic like we'd never seen before. And of course, much of it was coming from Spain, and much of it was coming from the UK, because people were either here or they were in the UK and they had, you know, properties here. And they needed to know what was going on. They needed, you know, up-to-date, reliable information. So, so we saw a huge spike in traffic. We worked, but, you know, we're not set up to work weekends. There's only three of us on the team, but we worked every weekend, I think, from sort of March up until mid-June, because there was so much stuff going on at the weekend. Pedro Sanchez had this penchant for coming out and making an important speech on a Saturday evening at about 9 p.m., which was a complete nightmare. So we very much had our hands full, and it's been a very busy time. I mean, it's, you know, like I said, it's always exhilarating when you've got a major story to be covering. And with the podcast, you know, we've had a lot of really positive feedback from readers who have been very grateful to get, you know, reliable information, because there's a few publications out there in Spain in English which just have to be seen to be believed. I won't name names, but there's a few that publish some very, very questionable news stories.
Like the Daily Mail of Benidorm or something, I suppose.
And that sort of stuff is not helpful in a situation like this, where it's, you know, there's certain stories that have caused panic and alarm.
And communications, I mean, there's so many different levels of government in Spain. But I think, like, the pinnacle for me has been, like, in the state of alarm, no one could do anything. But then when it all went back to the regions, you know, you sort of concentrate on your own region. I'm in Madrid, same as you. And I've been following your Twitter feed, and it's like looking in the mirror a bit with with how I feel. Has it been that big a headache the last couple of weeks in Madrid to work out what's going on? And, you know, because Madrid is the sort of central focus at the moment. I think it's like 35% of the infection rate, 14% of the population. And it's just been like power games for the last 2 weeks. And then, you know, last Friday we finally got locked down. So I don't know, how's it been for you as a journalist reporting on this?
Yeah, I mean, Friday was probably you used the word pinnacle. I would probably call it the nadir. Friday was the worst day, because all of this, you know, all of this argy-bargy between the central government and the regional government really came to a head. If this pandemic has done anything in Spain, it's served to illustrate how dysfunctional the system of government is in Spain. Because of the system of the regions, you know, sort of 20 years ago or so, I think it was healthcare and education were devolved to the regions, meaning, you know, obviously that they were taken out of the central government's hands. Now, what happened under the state of alarm was that the central government assumed control of those competences and was able to, you know, handle the pandemic in a centralized way. There was this brief fleeting moment of political unity, which is very rare in Spain, as everyone who's, you know, spent any time studying the country will know. But then very quickly it all started to go south, and in particular in regions which were run by the Popular Party, the Conservative Popular Party, or regions that traditionally have wanted independence from Spain. They started to make a lot of noises about how, you know, the state of alarm should come to an end and the competences should be returned to the regions. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, the state of alarm was the support for the state of alarm was waning in Congress. I mean, it looked less than certain whether and the Prime Minister was actually going to be able to keep extending it because the votes were starting to run out. So he basically did what they asked. He handed back the powers to the regions. And since then, we've seen the situation, certainly in Madrid, get much, much worse. Madrid is, really, I'm sort of talking to you about this more as someone who lives here than journalist. But I just find it, I was getting so angry watching that press conference on Friday because it just seems to be that the Popular Party's approach is just to blame the central government for everything, to blame them when they haven't got the competences, to blame them when they have got the competences, to blame them when, the central government isn't doing anything, and then to blame them when the central government actually does something. So,
yeah.
A lot of this is coming from the current Madrid Premier, Isabel Díaz Ayuso, who is a very inexperienced politician. She was sort of this big star of the PP leader, Pablo Casado's. She didn't win the election. I mean, it's worth pointing out, she didn't win that regional election. The Socialist Party actually won the election, which hasn't happened in Madrid for decades. But as in many other areas of Spain, they managed to cobble together a coalition with citizens propped up by Vox. In the year that they've been in power, they've only actually managed to pass one law. That was passed last week. And rather than being anything to do with the pandemic, it was actually to do with the rezoning of land, which, if anyone knows anything about the Popular Party, is quite funny because there's been a lot of dodgy dealings over the years in terms of rezoning of land for commercial purposes. Isabel Díaz Ayuso seems to be sort of following this kind of Esperanza Aguirre school of politics. Esperanza Aguirre was a former mayor of Madrid and regional premier. And she's very, very famous for lots of different reasons, but I think in particular for that kind of style. And this is the strategy that Ayuso seems to be following. She actually, in an interview with the ABC newspaper yesterday, she actually went so far as to say that the central government is imposing these restrictions on Madrid so that it can take the credit for the improvements that are currently being seen in the epidemiological situation in Madrid, which is quite an extraordinary claim. The counter argument to that is, well, maybe just what the central government is doing is seeing the figures in Madrid, which are just horrendous in terms of cumulative incidents of new coronavirus cases, and is taking action as many voices are calling on it to do. So in terms of communication, the message that they'd obviously all agreed that they would come out with on Friday on the part of the regional government was to repeat the word chaos at the press conference that I was referring to just now, that was making me very cross. Two of the regional chiefs, the justice chief and the health chief, came out to announce that they were taking these measures because the government was basically forcing them to. And they just kept repeating the word chaos. They just kept saying that there's going to be chaos, and this is because of the central government's measures. And at about the same time, Ayuso sent out a tweet saying, "Thanks for the chaos, Pedro Sanchez," or something like this, which everyone immediately said was very reminiscent of when an infamous tweet went out about the King's Day parade when Manuela Carmena was the mayor of Madrid, and a high-ranking PP member said, "I'll never forgive you, Manuela," because the three kings were dressed in these sort of fairly amateurish costumes that year. So it was one of those tweets. And so that was obviously what they wanted to get out there. But I mean, really, the chaotic situation has been brought about by the regional government. When these measures went into effect on Friday, they actually lifted the confinement of the basic healthcare areas, the 45 basic healthcare areas that they themselves had implemented over the past 2 weeks, essentially meaning that now people that were in those areas, those neighborhoods like Vallecas, which are suffering the worst at the moment with the high infection rates, they can actually move now freely around the whole of the city of Madrid, which doesn't seem to make much sense. And then, as the icing on the cake, the mayor of Madrid tried to blame that over the weekend on the central government. But the official state gazette that was published by the central government that put these measures into place actually, you know, specifically stated that a region can put, you know, the additional restrictions that it sees fit into place. So it really is, you know, it's this poisonous politics that's being played out. When really, I mean, you may have seen my tweet that I tweeted out last week. Wouldn't it be great to run a coronavirus story that's actually about combating the pandemic rather than, you know, all this political infighting? It really is. It's an absolutely it's a shameful situation as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I mean, you were saying like this is like a regional problem for Madrid, and I was looking a bit earlier because normally, you know, in Spain, in the media, anything that's negative about Catalonia is like blown up, but I remember, as you were saying, you know, the regional premiers were complaining during the lockdown, and Torra was one of them, wasn't he? The president of Catalonia. But Catalonia acted a lot quicker after the lockdown. And I had a look at some figures from that. I think it was the Polytechnic University of Catalonia. And they say this was figures from the 17th of September, so it's like two weeks ago now, that, you know, Catalonia had 768 people in hospital with coronavirus. Madrid had 2,800, and coronavirus beds, it was like Madrid 392 versus 135 in Catalonia. Catalonia's got, you know, Barcelona and Madrid are very similar in aspects of population and things. So it does make you wonder, really, you know, if Madrid had acted quicker, because Torra, you know, confined some large parts of Western Catalonia quite early on. If Madrid had acted quicker, maybe we would be in a similar situation to Catalonia now. I'm not really sure, to be honest.
I think that's right. I think that's very fair to say. I mean, and you only have to, you know, you only have to look at Ayuso's comments. You know, she doesn't want to lock down the city. She, you know, saying, you know, the economy won't be able to take it. She also, in another quote yesterday in that ABC interview, said this is not about confining, you know, 100 people just so that one person can get better. To which one of my colleagues from the head of the science section actually said, yes, no, actually that is exactly what it's about. That is what it should be about. So you know, you can see from her own statements that she's been incredibly unwilling to consider any other kind of generalized lockdown. And this basically is the result. And unfortunately, I mean, if obviously there's major differences between the first wave and the second wave. But I think the figures are, if you consider the figures, the cumulative incidence of coronavirus cases over the last 2 weeks in Spain in general is something off the top of my head, it's something like 250 on average. In Madrid, it's something like, it's over 700. Jeez. And in parts of Madrid, it's over 1,000, which is insane. I mean, the story has just gone up on the El País website about how, you know, in Paris and New York, they're shutting down schools and applying new, really, you know, major restrictions with rates that are way lower than we're seeing in Madrid at the moment. So we could be headed to a really bad situation, of course, on the basis that you know, the average time between symptoms and you know, a fatality in a COVID-19 case is sort of between 2 and 3 weeks. So we could be back in a very serious situation before long. And it, you know, this is one of these things where I would love to be proved wrong. No satisfaction whatsoever to be right about this. I hope it's not the case, but
no.
You know, I don't want to alarm anyone, but I you know, if it weren't for the kids, I would have gone back to England. I'd be in a little corner of the, you know, Essex Suffolk border with my parents, just kind of hiding until it's all over. I mean, it's a really, you know, it's a very, very worrying situation. And yeah. just unbelievable that we're back here so soon. And a lot of it is to, you know, the track and trace never went into place. The primary health care was never shored up. Madrid left the whole organization of the schools so late that, you know, the staff were threatening a strike. Just in the last week, they've changed the criteria for testing. Now, if my son's class got confined after 9 days because of a positive among one of his classmates, and they changed the criteria. Originally, they were going to do PCR tests on all students in a class when there was a positive, and they've changed it to only do PCR tests if there's symptoms now. That's also going to be the case if there is a case detected, you know, between your contacts, if they, you know, do a track and trace operation, you know, not everyone will be tested anymore. So of course, if you do less testing, you're going to find fewer positives. But you know, what's the consequence of that for public health? It's really very concerning.
Yeah, and as you said earlier about it, you know, it's really exposed the poor system of governance in Spain. I think as well, like with the data reporting to the health ministry. I mean, I think it's Madrid, Comunidad of Madrid has more health employees than the Ministry of Health does, because obviously health is decentralized. So the Ministry of Health is quite a small department. But the figures reporting has been a bit off between the regions and the central government as well. And I mean, that seems to be, I think there was like a couple of days where, you know, Madrid didn't even report their figures, which is, you know, it's worrying because it's the capital and it's the bit that connects the rest of Spain, you know, like connects everything together, doesn't it? So, you know, strategically, Madrid should have been the one that should have been looked after best, but it seems to be the one that's going to tilt the second wave to the rest of Spain. I don't know.
Exactly. I mean, that's been another one of the issues. You know, the issue basically now at the moment, we have 17 different regions doing 17 different things. And that also extends to, you know, the reporting. The reporting right from the start has just been a disaster. You know, why the health ministry couldn't impose, you know, a standardized system of reporting right from the start, I just will never understand. I've never found a sufficient explanation for it, apart from the fact that you just had 17 different regions all doing different things, because they were reporting things in different ways. So it's just impossible to, it was impossible to compare data properly because they were measuring, you know, they were adding cases, and it was just all a huge mess.
Just going back a bit, we had this like massive lockdown, and then August came, and you know, historically in Spain, August is a month that business is shut. You know, in my local neighborhood, most of the business is shut for the whole of the month. And I would have thought after the state of emergency, you know, people would have carried on working through August, but from my point of view, it wasn't necessarily the case. The politicians went on holiday, you know, these things. Do you think that this has sort of added to it as well? You know, there was sort of such a lax after the lockdown that it's just made it all chaos, like not in Madrid as the Isabella Ayuso was saying, but in the whole of Spain, like with regards to the coronavirus lockdown.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are all these questions are being asked as to how it could all go wrong again so quickly in Spain. And one of the things that the experts and my colleagues have been pointing to is exactly that we had, you know, the de-escalation went too quick, and that people were too keen to get back to, you know, normal life without taking into account that, you know, normal life is really, it has to be put on hold for a while. You know, when I very, very early on, when I was doing some interviews for the BBC, for the World Service, and, you know, talking about how this was going to play out in Spain. And I remember saying right from the start, you know, this is a virus that is so at odds with, you know, Spanish way of life, and, you know, in terms of all the kissing, you know, the day-to-day kissing, or the way that, you know, generations tend to live together, the way that people tend to have second residences and go out and spend time in El Pueblo You know, the highly social nature of Spanish life. You know, we used to go down with our kids every Saturday or Sunday, go down to the bar downstairs and stand at the counter or sit, you know, sit down by the fruit machine and, you know, and have our beers and see all the people from the neighborhood and all these kind of things. They're just, you know, they're obviously in terms of this coronavirus, all of these things are things that we, you know, we shouldn't be doing. And you just have to look at the reopening of the terrace bar. I mean, who knew that Spain was so dependent on its bars and terraces? I mean, it's extraordinary how important that these businesses are for the economy. But if you look at, you know, the way that even that was done, you got people, you know, it's been obligatory for a while to walk around the street in, I think it's all of Spain, isn't it, with a face mask on.
Yeah.
People walk around the street with a face mask on, but then they sit down on a terrace with people that they don't live with, take their face mask off and sit there for 2 hours and chat and eat and smoke. And they're not at a sufficient distance. I mean, it was supposed to be, you know, 2 meters. Then I think Theo Llanos managed to get it down to 1.5 meters so that, you know, capacity would be great and, you know, bars and restaurants wouldn't suffer so much. But even now they changed it recently. I believe so. It was supposed to be that, you know, the actual diners would be 2 meters or 1.5 meters apart rather than just the tables, because they just had the tables, you know, at that distance apart. And you see these scenes and you think, well, no wonder this isn't working. Well, what's the point? You know, we were up in Avila last week. We were walking around the mountains and I'm supposed to be walking, you know, no one around. I was supposed to be walking around with a face mask on, but then I could go drive down into the town and sit at a terrace bar with people I don't live with, take my mask off and sit there and talk and do that inside as well. So obviously, you know, there's going to be as time goes on, there'll be a proper sort of, you know, analysis of exactly what went wrong and what are the measures that worked and what are the measures that didn't work and just why things went so badly here. But I think there's a lot of cultural elements about life in Spain. And it's so sad because it's all the stuff that we as foreigners who come and live here, it's all the stuff that we love, you know.
Yeah.
Close family, the social life and all of that kind of stuff. And unfortunately, it's all of this kind of stuff which seems to be actually, you know, spreading the virus further. Mm. And then, of course, you know, there are people that just aren't respecting the rules. You know, we've heard lots of different stories of, you know, parties being broken up, kids going out doing botellones. Over the weekend, there was a private party with 200 people in it, in a house in an upscale part of Madrid that was broken up. And so, obviously, you know, we can blame the government as much as we want and the various other administrations, but also, you know, there is an element of people not doing what they're supposed to be doing and not showing proper responsibility in their actions.
Yeah, no, definitely. My last question for you that isn't related to coronavirus is regarding the unlikely celebrity James Rhodes has become a celebrity in Madrid. So for those that don't know, James Rhodes is a concert pianist from the UK. He moved to Spain, I think, 4 years ago. And he has become an absolute star on Twitter. Tweets all in Spanish. And Spaniards just seem to have taken to him like he's a new, like he was the Beatles coming or something. Can you explain where this comes from and why?
Well, the thing I love about James Rhodes is that in his tweets, when he tweets out these things, you know, he'll find a new kind of stew or something and he'll tweet, oh my God, this stew is amazing. I love this country. And he'll just like, his delight in the sort of, you know, the everyday elements of life in Spain or life in Madrid and the Spanish language and stuff like that. I love, because it just reminds, I feel like I was the James Rhodes of the year 2000 to 2003, but without Twitter and not being, you know, without being famous, because it just, you know, when I moved here when I was, you know, I was 21 and I just, you know, I just absolutely fell in love with Madrid and with Spain and the people and the food and the lifestyle. And I love that because it's kind of, for me, it's just, you know, because obviously after 20 years, it just becomes your normal life. And while you appreciate it, you don't have that sort of, you know, wide-eyed enthusiasm for it that he does. So I love reading his tweets about that, which is, which are just delightful. But yeah, I think there's an element of, I think this is it kind of, this is, I think Spaniards love it when someone comes from abroad and just, you know, takes great delight in their country. I think it's sort of still that, I think it's still sort of still a lingering inferiority complex that in the Spanish psyche to a certain extent. And I certainly that's always been my experience that people have always been so thrilled when I express just how much I love Spain and, you know, the things that I love about Spain. Also, they love it when they see someone who is really taking the time and the effort to learn Spanish properly and to and to really integrate and, you know, not sort of fall into that trap of, you know, that a lot of British expatriates do of living in areas where they, you know, are surrounded by other Brits or and don't really integrate, don't really learn the language and don't really learn much about the country. But there's a dark side to it as well, because he gets a huge amount of abuse on Twitter. I mean, Twitter is a very toxic place. And James is a sexual abuse survivor from when he was a child. And he's a campaigner on that topic. And some of the things that are said to him in the form of insults are just horrific. And I kind of get the impression that he might be struggling with that a little bit at the moment from his recent tweet. So that's very sad, because there's always that, and this, you know, in a post-Brexit world, this is happening in the UK as well, that, you know, if you are not from a country and you, you know, venture an opinion on that country, then people immediately say, well, if you don't like it, go back home, which is obviously completely is a ridiculous argument. If you know, if someone it was to say that to me, I'd be like, well, excuse me, I probably paid more tax in Spain than you have. I've been living here and working here for 20 years. It's a free country, and I will have, you know, whatever opinion I want to about the politics of, you know, any country, even if you don't like it. So yeah, it's quite a phenomenon, the way that he has worked himself into the sort of the national scene. But yeah, delightful to see, and all power to him.
No, definitely. It's one of the positive celebrities most positive celebrities I've seen in Spain for a long time. So no, it's great that, and it's great that he's political as well, you know,
yes,
and involved absolutely. In things. He's certainly very vocal about, you know, certain parties, and it's good to see some support for, you know, for causes, everything really. I think he's just a great guy. So James, if you are feeling down, we send our love from this podcast, and keep on fighting the good fight, definitely.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much for joining me, Simon. It was a pleasure to have you on.
Yeah, it was great. It was nice to be back on the air. Hopefully we'll get back the kid podcast up and running.
Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Simon, for coming on the Sobremesa podcast. If you want to follow Simon on Twitter, you can find him on the handle @SimonInMadrid. If you've enjoyed these interviews, please share and subscribe with your friends and family and anyone else like-minded. We're trying to reach 200 listeners a week on average by Christmas. Last week, we hit 150 listeners in 1 week. Remember, you can listen to all episodes of the Sobremesa podcast on all podcast platforms. This goes from the history of the Catalan independence movement all the way through to the historical memory movement and the formation of the Spanish identity. I'll be back next week with another interview for you. I hope you have a great week, and remember to stay safe.